right. Well, let's pray. Lord, thank you for a new day. A new day, and thank you for a new time in your word. We ask now that your presence would be here in a very special way. Surprise us tonight. Surprise us in your word. Surprise us in directing and guiding us through the wandering and the wilderness. Surprise us tonight. Lord, now as we open the book of Numbers up for the next few weeks, we ask that you would be present here in this time and this space. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Everybody doing good? Everybody got, you know, recuperated and everyone is doing well, I trust. That will be a good thing. Tonight we are switching gears to the book of Numbers. Again, we've mentioned that the Pentateuch, or the, well, Pentateuch, it's got penta, meaning five, the five books of the first books of Moses. Those five books of Moses are, of course, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Numbers is perhaps the most peculiar of the books of Moses, the five books of Moses. Doesn't fit. It's sort of a fusion of stuff. Yeah, it's the combo platter. It is the combo platter. But it's a fusion. Don't forget to get the notes. We got notes, extra notes. It is a fusion of the stuff that we went over in Leviticus, because it kind of picks up right where we left off in Leviticus. But then it's got some cool stuff where we left off in Exodus 17, where they're starting to fight people, starting to get in kind of the warfare. It's got that in there. And it's got some really wild stories in it. I mean, some stuff that's just so off the chart wild it isn't funny. So for that reason alone, it's worth worth studying. Just to give you some idea about time in the book of Numbers. Up to this point, Exodus takes place over a period of, starts with the birth of Moses, and then it's about 80 years to when Moses starts his ministry. He's about 80 years old. The book of Exodus doesn't tell us that, but other books do tell us that, particularly in Acts, in the New Testament. That's where we learn that Moses is, his life can be kind of in 40-year chunks. The first 40 years of his life is in Pharaoh's court. The next 40 years of his life is in Midian, serving his father-in-law, Jethro. And I do love the name Jethro, I really do. You know, I had a parishioner in Texas, and her last name was Bodine. Bodine. But her husband's name was not Jethro. His nickname, and you know, so my children used to think sometimes, Dad, do you work on a pirate ship or something with all the names that were on you? His nickname was Skeeter. Skeeter. We had at least one, a couple juniors, a Skeeter, two Bubbas in this congregation. I'm not making any of this up. This is all factual. You can fact check me, or use your Google machine to fact check me if you so desire. No, I doubt that it's on Google that they have that sort of. But Jethro, his father-in-law, he worked for him for 40 years, and then he leads the children of Israel for 40 years. The book of Numbers is almost 40 years long. It starts when they've been in the wilderness for about a year, okay? They've been in the wilderness for about a year, and then it ends with Moses just in sight of the promised land. Now, you won't notice that when you're reading through it, because it just kind of, once we get to the part where they're telling the narrative of what's going on in Israel, it'll be like hitting the throttle. You just sort of go zipping through this, like, you know, where did these 40 years of wandering in the wilderness go? So that's a little bit, time's a little bit deceptive in the book of Numbers. You start out, as I said, in the book of Numbers, looking at where you picked up, where you left off in Leviticus. There are seven distinct sections in Numbers. And it kind of goes back and forth between what would be the narrative of the life and history of Israel, which is the stuff that people find the most interesting, and the whole litany of regulations. The regulations are divided into two types, two kinds of regulations. There are the things which, here's how you're supposed to order your community. We went all over that when we talked about Leviticus. But also, the actual nuts and bolts of putting together the tabernacle. You will recall that the second half of the book of Exodus was all about, here's how you design the tabernacle and all the stuff that goes with it, and here's how you put it together. Well, there's a very large section in Numbers of it. Here's how you move it. Now, you think, well, you know, moving a tent's not that hard, okay? And moving a tent's probably not that hard. It's the stuff that goes with it. It's the stuff that goes with it. Because what is the stuff made out of?
Gold.
Now, last time I checked, gold is fairly dense. Fairly dense. I'll refrain from my normal density joke. Oh, boy, did I get the power eye roll there. It's one of my favorite jokes, and I'm just so proud that I made it up. You know, Minnesota is the place where Lutherans are most dense. What? There are a lot of them. Did you think I meant something else? I mean, even though, no. But in any case, gold is very dense, and they have a lot of it, and so carting it around is pretty hard. And when you think about this, how do you go about doing this? Well, the first part of the book of Numbers it explicitly tells you how to order the camp and how to break a camp. And let's get your you got a spiffy little in your. Oh, let me hang on a second here. Get my notes out here. Okay, that's not. There we go. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Ooh, it made it in color too. Oh, neat. Okay, this page, page 91. By the way, these are sequential, so they match the other ones. You have this very spiffy chart we're going to go over tonight and talk about that a little bit. And then on the next page, page 93, you've got some more. Did we run out? There's a whole bunch? Okay, all right. Just want to make sure we didn't run out. Okay. Then there's some more stuff about how to go about this. Okay, all right. With be that as it may. Yes? The seven are in the outline. Yeah, the seven major sections are in the outline. And we're going to try to do one section a night. Okay? Roughly, we're going to try to do one section a night. Because we have eight, I know, but we'll do something other fun, some other fun thing. Yeah, we'll figure it out. But did everybody get one?
I think they ran out.
I see, I knew they did.
Okay.
Did anybody not get one? Okay, here we go. This is the one you want right there. Okay, now we're in good shape. Okay, whoops, sorry. There we go. Okay, now we're in good shape. Okay, I'll use this one. All right, I'm just thrilled that you're all here tonight. That's great. Now let's talk about why is it called Numbers. The Hebrew Bible names things differently than our Christian Bible does. And that goes with the Old Testament as well. Well, there is no New Testament in the Hebrew Bible. They name things by the first words. And the first words of the book here is this. It's Bar Midbar, which means the practice is to count. These are the words of. Then the Greek is arithmetoi, for those of you who do math real well, means to count, and then that got transferred to numeri, and that's numbers. So what's going on here is there's taking two censuses. My mother worked for the census a couple years. You know, you can only do it, you know, every 10 years. But my mom did that. She was a census taker, and so it was kind of interesting. But they took two censuses. There's a census at the beginning, and there's a census at the end. And that's a particularly pertinent as to why this is. And this census is a bit of a problem. I'm just going to be straight up. Let's turn in our notes here that what we have here, chapter 1 of Numbers. We start out by, there's a census of who their warriors are. That's actually what they mean by warriors, is men who are older than 20 years old to 60 years old. I think that's what it is, 20 to 60. Is that right? Is that the right number, 20 to 60? In any case. And then they have some leaders listed there, a couple of unbelievably hard names to pronounce. But then you have the census. Now, this is about a year into it. It took about a year for all the going up and down at Mount Sinai. They're going up and down, up and down, up and down at Mount Sinai. And it took about a year to do that. And so you've got this census to begin with. And in this census time, you have a lot of stuff going on and telling you how to do this, that, and the other thing. And we'll get to that tonight. The next section that we'll look at later on in this series is you get a lot of murmuring going on. And you will recall, we're going to do maps next week. They're going to be, bring your book if you happen to have your book, but if you don't, I'm going to have the maps up on the screen next week, just to let you know that. But if you happen to have your atlas with you, and if you don't have an atlas, let me know, and I'll see if we can't order some more atlases, because they're, see me afterwards if you don't have one of those handy-dandy atlases, because they are really good, and if you don't have one, we can try to order some more for y'all. But no, Bob, we're gonna do the maps next week. There's seven maps we'll look at, but not this week. But there's a lot of murmuring. But I think you might be out of practice. Do you remember what our liturgical response is for murmuring? Let's do this in unison for crying out loud. You know, I want to tell you something. If the liturgical police were to break in the door, they'd haul me away anyway. There's no two ways about that. They would cart me off for all manner of infractions. But let's do this together on the count of three. One, two, three. You have to say it three times like you mean it, okay? You have to say it three times like you mean it. And the book of Numbers is filled with murmuring. There's all manner of murmuring, all manner of circumstance. Remember we were talking about circumstances on Sunday and how we're supposed to respond to circumstances? We're not supposed to murmur about the circumstances. We're supposed to turn the circumstances into opportunities for advancing the gospel. That's how we should look at things. But no, not these fine folks. They like to murmur. They like to complain. They like to grumble in their tent, which is, again, a favorite metaphor of mine. People whining and complaining and just being just downright cranky and ornery. So we have that as another section. There is a lot of that that goes on. And that's chapters 11 and 12. There's some interesting stuff going on. Perhaps one of the funniest parts in a very grim and ironic and dark way. One of the funniest passages in the entire Bible is in that section. That's in 2 weeks from now. So then the next section we have to look at, and this is perhaps, you really don't want to miss this one. This is when we talk about spying out the land. This is chapters 13 and 14. Chapters 13 and 14 are, again, one of those watershed passages of Scripture that if you miss this, you miss a lot. You miss why God is so cranky with Israel and what Israel has done to make him so cranky towards them. It really is a watershed passage. It's not as important as some of the other passages that I've talked to you about, but it helps you understand those key Old Testament passages. And this is all about going and spying out the land. They send the spies out for 40 days, and we're going to spend a good amount of time on that. And it actually, as I said, it's a significant piece of the narrative, and it's going to be interesting, I think. There's a lot of life lessons for us in this, too. Some of the stuff when we see, you know, they brought so many gold platters, they brought so many dead cows, they brought, you know, there's not a whole lot of life lessons in that for us. I mean, there might be some. But this stuff, there really is. This is the stuff that you just want to sink your teeth in and you can learn a lot for your own walk of faith. So that's an important one that we'll talk about. Spying out the land, chapters 13 and 14. Then the next section is the section of rebellion in the camp. This is where the litany of we're going to die in the wilderness gets to a fevered pitch. This is chapters 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. I bet it's Mark, huh? Let's see if it's Mark. No, it's not. Don't know who that is. This is where this whole idea of rebellion comes. And if you saw the movie, The Ten Commandments, this was a lot of fun to watch this, as I said. This was a great scene to watch the earth swallow these folks up whole. So that's another interesting one. Then death in the camp. A lot of time passes, and there are several significant deaths that take place. How many of you saw Rogue One? Only a handful of you saw Rogue One. Rogue One, yeah, the latest Star Wars. Well, yeah, well, I mean, one of the great controversies, I hope I'm not spoiling anything for anybody, but how many people die in this thing?
Everyone
dies in this thing. I mean, as I said, everyone dies, which is not a very Disney sort of thing. And for that matter, if you look at the Star Wars sort of thing, which is just kind of very uplifting, it's not a very Star Wars sort of thing. But I'm of the opinion, as being someone who has enjoyed the Star Wars franchise for it since its inception, that this is probably the second best movie. That is, in my mind, the second best one, and only the first one, the very, very first one, was better. But this answers a lot of questions in that. But the very, very first one left you so uplifted and so happy. But you know, we have this Disney-esque understanding of the world that we always want to be happy. Well, the Book of Numbers doesn't end happy. But for that matter, the whole Pentateuch doesn't end happy. But in Numbers, a lot of people die, and some very key people die. Miriam dies, which is Moses' sister, and Aaron dies, which is Moses' brother. And the question then becomes is, who is Miriam and why is she important? And we'll talk about that. And we already have kind of understood who Aaron is and why he's important because he's the chief priest. Well, what do we do now? And in this, you will see, in the book of Numbers, you will see the rise of Aaron's third son because his first two got smoked in the tabernacle for doing things wrong, his third son, Eleazar, and he becomes a key figure. So it's how do we transfer leadership? Which, if you're interested, I mean, this is actually a really important feature of the latter two books of the Pentateuch, Numbers and Deuteronomy, because people do die. And how do you raise up a leader to come after that? The whole issue of succession planning, I don't know, maybe at your work you might have succession planning or maybe not. One of the worst places of succession planning, the church. Churches do really bad jobs of success. I mean, I haven't come across a church yet that really has given it serious consideration on how to make that succession plan work. It oftentimes is not very thoughtful. But yet the Bible is filled with lots and lots of good examples that business could learn from about successful succession planning. Because the succession plan between Aaron and his son Eleazar is quite successful and quite smooth. But more importantly, of course, that one's pretty well defined. This is how we're going to do this. More importantly, the succession plan between Moses and who comes next is ingenious, absolutely ingenious. And that's actually one of the last things that we'll talk about when we finally get to Deuteronomy chapter 34, because that's really a lot about what Deuteronomy chapter 34 is like. What comes next? And there's some serious and unexpected spiritual implications about what comes after Moses. It's a great question. What comes after Moses? Okay, now, moving right along. So we have rebellion in the camp and we have death in the camp. And then in chapters 20, 21, and I think through 24, chapters 20 through 24, perhaps the most unusual narrative in the whole first five books of the Bible. Because it's the account of Balaam and Balak. Balaam is a prophet, a holy man, and Balak is a king. And what's curious about this is throughout most of the Bible thus far, when we're talking about Adam and Eve, it's Adam and Eve and God, okay? Cain and Abel and God. Noah and God. Abraham and God. Isaac and God. Jacob or Israel and God. Joseph and God. It's always about the main character and God, and they're the main conversation. In Exodus, it's Moses and God. All of a sudden, something changes. Moses hasn't died. Moses is still the main human character. But all of a sudden, the camera shifts. It goes to a different scene. It goes to a different place altogether with different people. And something that's going to resonate through the rest of the Bible is going to take place here in this particular chapter, this little section, I should say. What resonates here is the whole spiritual issue of what is a false prophet? What is a false prophet? And this will become a reoccurring theme throughout the rest of the Bible. And here we will encounter Balaam, who is the prototype of all the false prophets who will come after him. And what is the spiritual implication of prophecy in general? And this is going to be a great, great passage. This is a great section right here. And we'll go over that as well in fairly detailed. Then the last section's a longer section that's got a mess of stuff in it. Again, one of the more comical, in a grim way, passages of the Bible is found in here when dealing with the Midianites. But again, a greater spiritual principle here is a lot of time has passed. You have some more of these regulations and rituals that are there. But also in the narrative, what's happened is that they finally made it. They can look over there. It's sort of like being, I'm sorry, there are probably people from Moorhead here, aren't there? There's probably, you make it to Moorhead. You take the ox trail all the way up from St. Paul, and you make it to Moorhead, and then you look across the river, and there's the promised land, North Dakota, right? Maybe not. but you understand what I'm getting at is that you've had this arduous journey, and I should have never read those roadside signs in the rest areas and found out about the ox road from St. Paul to Winnipeg. That must have been an arduous journey if you think about it. But here they've had this arduous journey, and it's just that close. They can, right on the other side, they can see it from the top of Mount Nebo. It's right over there. And what happens? And this is going to teach us one of the key spiritual lessons of our life. That the closer we get to the goals that God wants in our life spiritually, the greater the spiritual opposition that we will encounter, and the more sinister the spiritual opposition we will encounter. So it's kind of an interesting thing. Not that God doesn't have the victory still, because God does still. I mean, you know, I've read the last chapter. We win. Okay, so let's. It's a good thing. But I think it's also an important thing for us to keep in mind. I'll have some other examples that the sergeant gave me in life about. Air warfare and so forth, and I can be fact checked on that. So okay, I doubt that will be any much disagreement. I think you'll be in agreement on this one. So in any case, that's kind of the big picture of what we're going to be doing in the book of Numbers, and I hope to get through this before Lent, before Ash Wednesday, just to kind of let you know that the hope is there to get through this at that time. So. Be that as it may. And as I mentioned again, some of you came late. What's going on here? You see the tape and all that sort of stuff. We're having a new audio system put in. It's called Telecoil. And if you have any friends that have hearing aids, this is an amazing technology. What it does is it's a magnetic loop. It's not a radio broadcast. It's actually a magnetic loop that sets up a different kind of technology. It's not like these Williams receivers right here, because we have these Williams receivers, but they stay kind of coiled up because they're kind of bulky and people, it's tough putting them on. This thing broadcasts directly into your hearing aid, but you need to have your audiologist set your hearing aid up to it. It's the coolest thing in the world if you happen to have hearing aids, so I'm very excited about it. But I just want you to know that's there. So if you have any friends that have hearing aids, because sometimes people are more private about that, it's not necessarily something they tell, but if you know anybody like that, this would be a great thing for them. It's going to be wonderful. So we're looking forward to that. Okay. Let's hit it now. Okay. Numbers. Numbers chapter 1 and chapter 2. Well, let's turn in our notes a little bit, because what we have is the progression of the battles in the wilderness. It's important for us to see that when having a spiritual journey, we recognize that we oftentimes encounter opposition. That's something that we just need to be aware of. I mean, we need to be keenly aware that any time you are involved on a journey for God, you will likely encounter some sort of spiritual opposition. Well, these people encountered physical opposition. You'll see in your notes, it says, note the progression with the battles of the Promised Land. Israel's first encounter is with the Amalekites. We'll hear more about the Amalekites later, but the Amalekites are a bad bunch, and that's in chapter 17. This section we read that immediately come out against Israel right off the bat. Given what we will read in the future passages regarding this enemy, we might as well see a parallel to spiritual warfare in Israel's struggle with the Amalekites. This enemy of God's purposes seeks to destroy Israel in the infancy of her freedom from Egypt. Note who is present to engage in the spiritual warfare on Israel's behalf. It leads them into the battle. None other than Joshua, the son of Nun. Joshua's presence in this battle, he is of typological nature. That means he is a type of something. He is a type of Christ, so we'd expect him to find him there. Not to jump the gun too much, but the book of Joshua is all about warfare. People don't like the book of Joshua. That's what comes after Deuteronomy. And the reason why people don't like the book of Joshua, there's a lot of killing that goes on in it. There is a lot of killing that goes on. We'll deal with all that later, sometime, if we ever get there. I'm sure we will. But Joshua is considered to be a type of Christ, and we can talk about that later. Second, Israel's second encounter with the Amalekites is in Numbers 14. Again, we see the Amalekites as the enemies of God's people. Through this encounter, they defeat Israel's first attempt to get in the land. I don't know if you know that or not, but Israel tried to get in the land on their own, and the Amalekites are successful in pushing them back. So that's a next one. The next one encounter is that Edom, which are relatives of the people of Israel, the Edomites, they seek to pass through their land, but guess what? You know how brothers are. It was wonderful. This was just wonderful. It brought back so many pleasant memories. We were eating pizza in the fireside room tonight, and all of a sudden, at the top of the little boy's lungs, a squeal of torment came out of him. This is the little brother, because and a look of glee on the big brother, like, I didn't do anything wrong. And we were, of course, reminded of Mark and Ian when they were very much younger. But you know how siblings can be with one another. Well, Edom, Esau, is the brother of Jacob, Israel. So when here's poor beleaguered Israel coming out of 400 years of slavery, and so they come thinking that their brother's going to give them compassion, what happens? Not a chance. You got to go around. You got to go the long way. We're not going to let you off so easy. So that's the next encounter that they happen. Then next we have the defeat of Arad. That's Numbers 21. The chronology of Israel's encounter with Arad may not follow the order of other accounts in Numbers. This episode takes place on Israel's attempt to enter the Holy Land through Edom at the death of Aaron. On the one hand, the location is talks about is in the Negev, but on the other hand, the bigger question is, why did they simply not enter the land to the easiest way? This is a big question. We will look at the maps next week. Why didn't they just go straight in? Big question. Why didn't they just go straight in? And we'll look at that next week as to why they did not just go straight in. They had to come along the way. Then the next page, then we start knocking off other people. We knock off this guy, Sihon, king of the Amorites. He gets killed. Then we defeat Baish Og, king Og. I love that name, Og. Og. King of Bashan. And then lastly, we knock off Balak. So there are some wars that take place there. They're not as graphic as they are in Joshua, and so maybe that's why people aren't bothered so much by them. But be that as it may, you have this progression of war in the book of Numbers. Okay, with that in mind, let's get through those first couple 10 chapters today. As I said, one of the things that Numbers is about is numbering Israel. And you have on your page chart there, there are two censuses. There's the first census, which takes place at the beginning, and the second census, which takes place at the end. Now, this is for men who are able-bodied for war. That's the number that's represented here. Okay, you got the little chart there? Reuben has 46,500. Simeon has 59,300. Gad has 45,650. That's unusual. Then Judah has 74,600. Issachar has 54,400. Zebulun has 57,400. Ephraim has 40,500. Manasseh has 32,200. Benjamin has 35,400. Dan has 62,700. Asher has 41,500. Naphtali has 53,400. For a grand total of 603,550. Now, are any of you up to date on the current military strength of armies around the world? This would be a big one. For today, by today's standards, this would be a very big one. Now, this is all men, not just people, but they kind of drafted everybody. This does not include who? Well, doesn't include. Well, it doesn't include the Levites. That's right. The Levites are not included. You'll notice their names are not listed here. It does not include women. That's true. Who else? People older and younger. Them that's older, and particularly them that's younger. Now, this 20-year-old threshold will become a key thing later on. We'll see that. So, if you do the math, which is a very dangerous thing to do in the Old Testament, doing math in the Old Testament. Very problematic. We've talked about this before. This is not a math textbook, and anytime you do math in the Old Testament, your head will hurt, okay? Just to let you know that, your head will hurt. But if you do the math in it, you're looking at a population somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million people, okay? That's a fairly substantial population, which has caused people to scratch their heads and say, really? Is it really that big? And they've scratched their heads for a couple of reasons. Reason number one, not that it is so big a number that people in the ancient world wouldn't have had the population. The estimate for the population of the land of Canaan, the whole land of Canaan, at the time when Israel sort of moves in, their estimate's about 3 million. So, I mean, it's not like ridiculously absurd. The real problem is that it does seem like a fairly substantial number of people to clothe, to house, to water, and to feed. Now, of course, when you get to have God on your team, you don't have to worry about stuff like that. But still, even using miraculous measures, you got to think about people have done crazy things like, okay, if there's 2.2 million people, how long would it have taken them to actually walk across the Red Sea if they're walking 1,000 across? It would have taken a long time. So, I mean, there is this practical aspect of this. Even all the way. Oh, the way, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yes, indeed. I wouldn't want to clean up after that. That's why you keep moving. That's right. Absolutely. What do you do then? Another thing is that when you look at, you throw the Levites, because the Levites are supposed to account for the firstborn. Well, there's a rather crazy ratio there that you'd practically have to have families of 27 to account for the Levite representing the firstborn. So it's a bit of a problem there. Some people have suggested that the word elep, which is the word Hebrew word for thousands, also can mean clans. And people have tried to make this go either way. Either make it a small number of, say, 20,000 people, which certainly would be a lot more manageable. Let's just be honest. 20,000 people are a lot more manageable than 2 million people. And I suppose you could fudge on that a little bit and say that's the case. But I got a question to ask you. If you're the Canaanites, and there's 3 million of you, and here comes the Israelites, and there's only 20,000 of them, why would you even be remotely afraid? Which it makes very clear in the book of Joshua that they're not just remotely afraid, that they are in fact absolutely terrified of this. The bigger number would be a terror-inspiring number. Let's face it, if there were 600,000 people armed and ready for war sitting in Jordan, waiting to go across into modern-day Israel, there would be some alarm in the world. I'm telling you, there would be some people would be alarmed at that. Even today, they would be alarmed by an army that size. So that would account for the alarm. The other problem is that these are such round numbers; they all end in hundreds, except one. And the funny thing is, and in the second census, they all end in hundreds except one. And it's not the same one. So that's kind of an interesting thing there. Now, the next second census, this is the first census. This is after year one, okay? Then at year 40, they take another census. And they have, and I've given you how much those that have grown and those that have declined. But there's an overall decline in the second census because the total census of the first one is 603,550. The total census in the second one is 601,730. Okay? Now, here's the other thing. With the exception of two people, these are not the same people. Because this 603,550 minus two, every one of them did what? Well, come on, say it. One, two, three. We're going to die in the wilderness. We're going to die in the wilderness. They died in the wilderness. That's what happened to them. They died in the wilderness. Now, of this other number, the 601,000, these are all people who are either A, under 20, or B, were born in the wilderness, okay? Which is kind of ironic in that sense. So that's the number that you have there, okay? Now, let's just say it's 20,000. Let's just say it's, 2 million. Still, you got to organize this stuff. Well, this little chart here that I have there, it's in color. Isn't that nice? I just think that's spiffy that it's in color. You have how the book of Numbers says how they're camped around the tabernacle. The tabernacle, or the tent in the meeting, is in the middle there, okay? And then on the north, actually, it begins with the east. That's interesting. That the list, when you read through chapter 2, it begins with the east. And then works around the points of the compass going south, west, and then north. There's something interesting about this, that if you were to look on a map, you would see that their enemies are to the east. And to the north. And so they leave, they head out that way, and so the last people to break camp are the people on their rear guard, which are facing the north. Interesting strategic way to do things. But there are people on the east, and then they would break camp, and that's how many there are there. There are people on the south, they would break camp, and that's how many there are. And there's people on the west, and that's how many there are, and so forth. Now, there's some little other information there that you might find interesting with regard to that. But let's flip over to the little chart there on page 93, at the top of page 93. There what you have is, as they're traveling, as they're going out, they have an order. They said, this is the order you're supposed to go in. And there's going to be this the east group, and they're followed by the people, the roadies. You know what roadies are, don't you? Roadies are the people that carry all the band's equipment. Well, somebody's got to be the roadie. And so you have the roadies here. Well, the roadies that carry the tabernacle, there are two tribes. Two partial tribes of the Levites. There's a clan of the Gershon and the clan of Merari. And they carry all the stuff of the tabernacle. Now, here's the cool thing. They get ox carts, okay? You want to be one of these people that even though you don't get to carry the cool stuff, at least you don't actually have to carry the stuff because you have ox carts that are carrying all this stuff for you. And the Numbers tells you how all the ox carts came to be, and that's kind of a cool thing. Now, just to kind of let you know, I've always found this. I always want to know what an ox was. You know, what species of bovine an ox was. Did you know there isn't one? What an ox is, now see, again, this is the suburban boy from Washington, D.C. What an ox is any bovine, any cow, any cattle that you use for draft purposes. And they do make pretty good draft animals, particularly in terms of their strength. They're maybe not as fast as a horse using as draft animal, but they tend to be stronger, which is kind of interesting. And, of course, you obviously breed cattle for these purposes, but it is any bovine that you would use for purposes of pulling something. So I was surprised to hear that. Again, they don't teach you that in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Then you've got the Reubenites and the Gadites. They're sort of coming up the next group. Then you've got the Kohathites. Now, what the Kohathites get to do is they get to carry all the fancy stuff, and they do literally carry it. You will recall that all the fancy stuff, that would include the Ark of the Covenant, that would include the table for the bread of presence, that would include the bronze altar, okay? It stinks to carry that one. That would include the altar of incense. That would include the bronze basin. They all have these structures. They're all made the same way. They have a wooden superstructure made out of acacia wood. And they have these rings on either side that you slap poles through and you carry them like that. You just want to tote them around like that. Again, because they're gold. They're going to be really, really heavy. So that's what, and you can't stick them on an ox cart, which we'll find out later. You don't just throw these things on an ox cart. That's not how you're supposed to carry all the holy stuff. So this is probably the thing that's slowing them down the most. So, but there they are, fourth. And then fifth, you have the tribes of the west, and then sixth, the tribes of the north. So you have this even spacing for protection, but also for mobility. So it's done in an orderly fashion. And what I want to point out here is this stuff was designed to be portable. It was designed to be moved from place to place. It was not designed to be made into a temple. It was designed to be moved. Temples tend to be rather rigid, wouldn't you say? We were having a discussion the other day. The old claims adjuster and me and the Saint and Mrs. Cross were having a discussion the other day about. Well, I went back to get the house ready for sale, and there was a sheet of glare ice on my driveway like I'd never. My driveway sort of sloped, and as I was going up my driveway, I gave it a running start, which was a mistake. I should have known better. And I found my car going sideways on it and heading right towards one of the pillars upon which the garage doors sit. And the sainted Mrs. Cross says, well, that would have been great. We could have got an insurance claim against it, and it would have been just wonderful. To which I reminded her, yeah, we had a little bit of weather strip, and that would have been covered. I said, well, no. You see, here's the thing. Cars are amazingly malleable. I mean, they're amazingly malleable because they're made out of metal. And metal bends and is malleable. Houses are not made out of metal, and they're remarkably rigid and stiff. And in the brief time that I adjusted claims on homeowners, I mostly did automobiles, but boy, you hit a house with a car, the car either you can fix or replace, the house you will have problems with forever because they just are not. They're hard. I mean, and it's the nature of buildings. They're not meant to be portable. They're meant to stay put. Well, here you have this contrast between tabernacle holding the holy things, how it was designed, and then somewhere along the line, somebody gets the idea of let's put this stuff in a fixed structure. So, this will come up as a problem much later on in the Bible, but it is a big problem. You know, we have somewhat of an idea. In chapter 35, you get a travel log. Chapter 35 gives you the travel log of how they went from place to place to place to place to place to place to place. So the answer is yes. As far as actual time in each place, maybe not so much. But that they picked up and went, picked up and went, picked up and went. Yes, it does. Now, for the most part, they stayed at a place called Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea, and again, when we get the maps out, we'll look at that next week. But yes, chapter 35 pretty much outlines, and then we went to here, 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 and then we went to here. Yeah. So the answer is, yes, they did literally wander in the wilderness. Yes. Doesn't say.
Doesn't say. Did they have a season or a time that they would pick up and travel? The Sinai is not a terribly seasonal place. The Sinai does have, well, I shouldn't say, let me rephrase that. The winters there are severe at night. I have this on, not firsthand, but secondhand discussion that you really don't want to be in the Sinai at night, even in the summertime, because there's nothing there to keep the heat in. It all just radiates off out into the atmosphere. It gets really cold in the desert at night, particularly in the wintertime. It's not that terribly far off the equator. I mean, it is significant. It's north enough off the equator, but they really don't have seasons per se like we would experience them here. So, yeah, good question. Other questions about their wandering? Oh, whatever you do. One of the things that's going to become very evident in this whole process is don't you even think about doing anything that the Levites do if you're not a Levite. It becomes very ugly and very ugly quick. And even if you are a Levite, don't you think about doing anything that specifically the tribe of Aaron or those that the descendants of Aaron are supposed to do? Because that's what chapter 16 is all about. You have this group of Levites that say, "You're not all that. You know, you think you're so special because your dad was Aaron. You're not all that." I said, "Yes, we are." "No, you're not." And we have this little contest between them. And so the answer is no. You are under no circumstances is anybody supposed to touch any of the stuff except the people who are assigned to touch the stuff. If you're of the one tribe, you get to haul the accessories. If you're of the other two tribes within Levi, you get to haul the tabernacle. Okay? But yeah, don't you be touching anything else. Don't you even think about it. So it will get very unpleasant for you if you do. Heck, if Aaron's two sons get toasted for putting up unauthorized incense in the tabernacle, what do you think is going to happen to somebody else? So be that as it may, you have that going on there in the moving of this stuff. Okay? All right. We're going to jump around a little bit now.
Just one thing. You know, I've been reading through Leviticus and Numbers.
Yep.
Talking about sacrifices.
Sure.
Firstborn lamb.
Yep.
Firstborn seems to be everything.
Firstborn seems to be everything. Primogenitor. Yes. Yes. Or primogenitor, depending upon how you want to pronounce that. Yes. Why is the firstborn everything? Well, this is a great irony in the Bible, because in that world, the firstborn was everything. And we've talked about this a little bit before. You know, those of us who are not firstborn or those of us who are not male don't get anything, and the firstborn male gets everything. And that was kind of the culture. There is a redemption of the firstborn in the whole process. Like if I were to say the firstborn male that opens the womb, I would have to offer a sacrifice for my son Stephen, but not for Mark or Ian or Mary. Mary because in their world too female, Mark and Ian because, hey, we've already done this. You know, we've already had the firstborn, okay? Now, the tribe of Levi is supposed to represent the firstborn of all Israel, of everybody else. This is what it works out to be about 23,000 people, And again, if you put 23,000 firstborn and do the math over across 600,000, you come up with some very large families. So, I mean, that's kind of the things that makes your head scratch. And again, as I said, don't attempt to use the Old Testament as a math textbook. You'll only hurt your head, as I said. Any attempts to try to do that, and I know that sounds funny because people think, oh, it should be factual in every absolute detail. And it is. However, it was intended. Whoever wrote it that way was intending to convey the truth as they understood it, not necessarily the truth as we understand. Let me give you an example of this. In Leviticus, okay, this is a good example. In Leviticus, there is a list of things of what you can and can't eat, right? And among the birds that you can and can't eat, one of the birds you cannot eat, in addition, you cannot eat ravens, you cannot eat cranes, you cannot eat crows, you cannot eat bats. Any objections? I mean, yeah, it's all right by me not eating a bat, but is it a what? Is it a bird? Well, not by our modern taxonomy. I mean, again, I made a point of our friend, what's his name? Linnaeus, yeah, Carl Linnaeus. Carl Linnaeus, a Swede and a Lutheran, came up with this idea of animal taxonomy, species taxonomy, and we know one thing for certain. Bats are not birds, bats are mammals. Bats are mammals. Leviticus calls them birds. Is this communicating an error? No. What it is communicating a truth in their understanding of the world. Their taxonomy is anything that flies and remotely resembles a bird is a bird. I don't care if it's got fur or feathers. It's a bird. Now, they're attempting to communicate that as a truth. Okay, so therefore, it's true in their understanding of it and how the original context is. The same is about the math of all this. I don't know exactly what's going on with the math of all this. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I have the plan to explain to you every detail of the math on this. Because if you look at it, it does make your head hurt. And again, I am not real good at math. That's why I'm a pastor. If I was good at math, I would have been designing cars in Dearborn or something like that. But
yeah.
Well, you know, a couple things. Actually, this is not later on history. It's in this time period, kids are dying right and left too. You know, if you make it to five, you'll make it. But you got to make it to five, and most of them didn't. You do need to see that there is a, and you know, you want to be careful playing the miracle card at every corner. But here, you do see that there is a statement of miraculous protection upon Israel. That God has a special protection upon Israel, even in the wilderness, even when he's ticked at him, even when he's just smoking mad at him, there is a protection upon Israel. And interestingly enough, he particularly protects in the wilderness those that are under 20. The ones that are above 20 are fair game. You. By the way, for those of you who don't know, this is my daughter here. She's auditing the class tonight. But in any case, and she is above 20, so
fair.
Nothing. I mean, you've already got it redeemed. I mean, it's the firstborn male that opens the womb. So if there's another male child that opens the womb, you don't have to redeem that child because the womb's already been opened. I don't need to go into any graphic detail about this, please, because I will get in trouble if I do. Yeah, but I mean, as I said, that's what it is. It's the firstborn male child that opens the womb, and then after that, all bets are off. You know, have at it. Okay? And they did have a lot of children. I mean, they did. I mean, having children was a big deal back then. I mean, again, you're living in an agrarian economy, pre-scientific worldview. You're living in a place where having a large family is a big, important thing for a number of reasons. First of all, in any kind of agrarian economy, you need labor, and you need loyal labor. And also in any kind of agrarian economy, particularly one like this, you need protection and you need loyal protection. And so you want to have as many children as you possibly can have. Both kinds, by the way, both kinds, because, and again, don't beat me up on this. Don't get angry. But this is just kind of the world. Because what you can do with your daughters is marry them off to the people that are living close to you, and they in turn will marry their daughters off to you, and so it's less likely, let's face it, if my daughter is living in the next town over, married to, you know, some clod that I just had to marry her off to, because, you know, he had, you know, three daughters of which I could marry my sons to, it's not likely that we're going to attack each other. Because my daughter's over there, and his daughters are here, and so that works. And so that's why you want sons, and you want daughters. You want them both, okay? There's a utility to both of them. And again, I don't mean to speak of humans in a utilitarian way, and I don't mean to be gender insensitive. I'm just saying how it was, okay? That's kind of that's how they that's the calculus that's going on in their minds. So having a big family is a good thing. It also goes to the issue of why you would have practice polygyny, more than one wife. Again, polyandry doesn't work. As I said, if there's, you know, one woman with lots of men they're married to, that just doesn't work because there's only one womb. When you have four productive wombs, then you're doing something there in this particular worldview, okay? Again, address your angry email to www.god.org. Okay, not to me. I didn't make this up. Okay. All right. Now, let's turn in our Bibles to chapter 6. And let's break it out and read. Because something is, we're going to find a little thing that we're going to go on with. For quite some time. We don't have the. Oh, you got it right there. Keith, crank it up there, brother. Glad to have you. Chapter 6, verse 1.
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, yes. Speak to the people of Israel and yes. Say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow.
Notice that this is a man or a woman. Okay, please note that.
The vow of the Nazarite.
Yes.
To separate himself to the Lord. He shall separate himself from wine and strong drink.
Mm-hmm.
He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink.
Notice that. No wine, no strong drink, but also no what?
Vinegar.
Okay, read on.
Shall not drink.
Oh, I had a doctor that used to prescribe vinegar. When we were at Boy Scout camp, it was really Lord of the Flies. There were no, so this was 2 weeks, no adults except on the weekends. And so anytime this 17-year-old would drive any kid into town, into Oakland, Maryland, and you need to see the Oakland, Maryland in 1965, that was quite the place. But the doctor prescribed vinegar for everything. And drinking it was part of that, too. Go ahead.
And shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried.
Okay. The reason why I'm saying this is because sometimes people get the goofy idea that the Nazarite vow is a precursor of why the Bible says we're not supposed to drink beverage alcohol, which is just plain silly. What is the Nazarite vow forbidding any contact with? Grapes in any form. Now, it happened to be the most portable form that grapes came in was wine. Let's face it, that's an easy way to transport a grape product, right? Because you can put it in a clay jar and carry it with you, and you don't have to worry about it rotting or doing anything else. But you kind of want it to rot because that way it turns into wine. But the idea is that it's any grape product, including raisins, which are dried, including grapes, which are not, including vinegar, which has gone sour, including wine, or including brandy, which would be the strong drink, because brandy is distilled grapes, okay? You know that there's a difference between how you make that stuff. That wine turns into alcohol through fermentation, brandy turns into alcohol through distillation. Different process. And they had figured that out, by the way. It's funny how we figure that out pretty quickly, huh? Why grape? Well, that's an interesting question. It's something that is a blessing, and so you are sort of depriving yourself of that. Grapes are, and wine particularly, is considered to be a blessing throughout the scriptures. Yeah. Living Lent all the time, exactly. Or no, not all the time, for a set period of time. Read on.
All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the skin, seeds or the skins. All the days of his vow of separation no razor shall touch his head. Mm-mm. Until the time it is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. Mm. He shall let the locks of his hair, locks of hair of his head grow long.
So this guy could put a man bun on, yeah.
All the days,
not like me.
He separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body.
No, don't do that.
Not even for his father or for his mother,
no.
For brother or sister, if they die. He shall make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation he is holy to the Lord. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing, and on the seventh day he shall shave it. On the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering, and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, because he sinned by reason of the dead body.
Mm-hmm.
And he shall consecrate his head that same day and separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering.
Mm-hmm.
But the previous period shall be void because his separation was defiled. And this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to the Lord. One male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering,
mm-hmm.
and a basket of unleavened bread,
mm-hmm.
loaves of fine flour mixed with oil,
mm-hmm.
and unleavened wafers smeared with oil,
mm.
and their grain offerings and their drink offerings.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord with a basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering.
Now that would be something from the grape, okay?
And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one of the unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration, and the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite.
Okay. Now, what's going on here? Nazarite means set apart or consecrated. You might say, well, why would you want to do this? Sometimes people want to have a time of closeness to God. And in a time of closeness to God, you do things like fast. That's something that some people do. We don't talk a lot about fasting in the Lutheran Church. It's just not a big part of our tradition. It's a shame that it's not, because it's a great spiritual exercise. But we don't talk a great deal about fasting. It does not work well with hot dish. That's absolutely correct. There's no question about that. Or donuts at, you know, in church. It just doesn't work well at all. But we don't do that, and it's kind of a shame. Another thing that we don't do much of is silent retreats. I'm throwing you stuff here all the time. I want you to know that.
Okay, I just want you to know. I'm well, that's okay. I just want you to know. But now that I did. But I mean, going on a silent retreat, going off and doing something in a silent retreat center. Again, that's not what we do, but it's a great spiritual exercise. I mean, I've often said, I mean, I've been on some silent retreats, and I don't know which is more terrifying, being alone with God or being alone with myself. You know, both of those are some pretty terrifying things. But they can have an incredible experience of getting close to God. I mean, there are a lot of things that we don't do in the Protestant tradition that are certainly a part of the Christian tradition that have great spiritual significance. And so when we see something like the Nazirite vow, we in the Protestant tradition tend to be a little bit more befuddled because we don't know what that's like. I mean, you know, who really gives up anything for Lent in a Protestant church? I mean, really, let's be serious. It just doesn't happen. Well, who does it in the Catholic Church, too? Come on. You do. It just lasts more than a day or two. But, you know, really, I mean, that's, you know, in the olden times, yeah, they had thumb screws on. They really kind of put it to you in the confessional. But, you know, but there's some great spiritual value in having these kind of experiences where you get closer to God. And this is one of them. It is that hair is an outward sign. But notice a couple things here. Number one, even though the male pronoun is used profusely throughout this section, it starts out by saying it's both for men and women. This is an equal opportunity kind of spiritual experience. All right? That's the first thing. The second thing is it is related to grapes because grapes are considered a sign of blessing. And it also, you know, it's kind of tough to live without grapes in that part of the world, in any capacity of it. I mean, it's kind of hard because that's what they would drink a lot of. They'd eat them. They have them dried as raisins. So it'd be kind of a tough sort of deal. So it would be a sign of self-depriving. So yeah, in order to be closer to God. And then there's this issue of not touching a dead body. You don't want to defile yourself ritually according to the Levitical laws, and you want to be really careful about doing that. Now, so there's what you've got right there. What's interesting is to see where this pops up. Let's turn to the book of Judges. We have an all-time favorite Nazirite. You just don't know him as a Nazirite, but even says that he is one. Yeah, oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, this is this guy doesn't do it for a period. He's a Nazirite from birth. Judges chapter 13. You know this story. You there, Keith, for me? Yeah, that guy, read.
And the people of Israel again did what is evil in the sight of the
Imagine
Lord.
Imagine that.
So the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years.
Favorite number, obviously.
It apparently is a big number.
There was a certain man of Zorah, of the mm-hmm. tribe of the Danites, mm-hmm. whose name was Manoah, mm-hmm. and his wife was barren and had no children.
Dang.
And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have not borne children."
Like she needed to be reminded of this.
"But you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head.
Nope.
For the child shall be a Nazirite to God from the womb."
All right. He is from his womb. So his mother is taking a Nazirite vow, and he will have a lifelong Nazirite vow. Well, let's talk about a few things. In practical use, Samson is said to be a lifelong one from his birth. Actually, he was to be a Nazirite from the womb, even. This would indicate that his mother took the vow as well once she was pregnant. Now, while nothing is specifically mentioned about foreigners, Samson has a pretty hard time with foreign women. He has an easy time with foreign women. That's part of the problem. Yes, indeed. Samson clearly violates the Nazirite vow by touching at least two dead things. Dead thing number one, the lion that he kills and has the honey and so forth. And dead thing number two, the jawbone of an ass. That is my favorite image in where he slays 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. I just love that. You know, where he takes this, he sees it sitting over there. Now, he's supposed to be a Nazarite. He's supposed to not touch anything dead, but he says, aha, here's this, and I'm going to use this to really put a can of, well, I won't say that, but you know. Yes, indeed. Absolutely. He breaks it out, and he does it to him. As to drinking wine and strong drink, nothing in the text explicitly says this, but he does go to a four-day wedding feast, and I want to know how he managed that in those times. But the most egregious violation of Samson's Nazarite vow was his cavalier attitude in revealing the source of his strength in his hair. Not that his hair was the source of his strength, but Samson's hair was symbolic of his separation to the Lord. Indeed, if Samson is remembered for anything, it is for revealing to Delilah the secret of his hair and thus allowing himself to become vulnerable. When we see the story of Samson, you know, in Sunday school we have it as a cute little story of isn't it great to be strong for God? Whatever you do, do not read chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18 and 19 to any of your Sunday school kids. Do not read this to them because you will blush. I mean, this guy is on the make constantly. He's on the make with prostitutes. I mean, this guy's just—he's crazy. But he is, you know, he is doing what, you know, what all the Israelites are cheering. He's killing Philistines. I mean, he kills Philistines with, you know, amazing ease. But he's very cavalier towards this attitude towards God that he has. Ultimately, he gives it up. He's shaved. He's blinded, but only in his death. Does his Nazarite vow return because he doesn't know, and then he destroys the Philistine temple and so forth. But it is an interesting picture into that. Some suggest also that John the Baptist had taken a Nazarene vow. There's kind of things both ways, but it doesn't explicitly say that. Here it explicitly says that Samson took this Nazarite vow, Nazarite vow, not Nazarene. And again, that's confusing, isn't it? I confused myself. Nazarene and Nazarite. They're, in Hebrew, you wouldn't make that confusion because they're completely different sounding. They're two totally different words. Nazarene has nothing to do with Nazarite, okay? Nazareth is a town where Jesus grew up, okay? And that's why he's called the Nazarene, but not Nazarite, okay? We're completely confused on that? Good.
So, the Nazarene Church.
Church of the Nazarene is a church which, curiously enough, the Nazarites would love because they're teetotal, but not with regard to grace. One of my best friends grew up in the Nazarene church, and so I always needle him about that sort of stuff. But be that as it may, yeah, that's where the Church of the Nazarene get their name from, yes. Okay. You will see poppings up of this thing, but the point here is this, is that Numbers is offering a situation where people can draw close to God in a special way that's out of the ordinary. And I think it's important for us to see that as a key thing in our own lives, that there are times in our spiritual walk that it's good for us to say, you know, I might need to do something that's different, that will help me draw close to God, that I will focus much more so than I normally do in my... Even if it's just for a season, even if it's just for a little bit of time. Paul may have been taking a Nazarite vow when he was going back to the temple. There's some indication in Acts chapter 21 and so forth that Paul might have been taking a Nazarite vow at that time as well. So it carried over even into the New Testament. This is something that's been around for a while. And I think that the idea, and again, we're not real good at this in the Protestant church.
So are some of the orders of nuns and monks, you know, some cloister themselves away?
There are monastic rules or monastic orders. Interesting, the difference in the Eastern Church and the Western Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Western Catholic Church, view things differently on these particular things, but those are the two branches of Christianity that practice this much more so than Protestantism. Much more so. You will see, for example, there are no orders. In the Catholic Church, there are Benedictines. And Luther was an Augustinian. And there are Franciscans. And there are other, different orders of monastic vows and so forth. It's a great system. I mean, somebody gets a burr under his or her saddle and says, I want to really focus on X. Well, fine. Go do that. Let me give you an example of this. One of the things in the 60s and 70s that devastated Protestant churches is charismatic renewal, speaking in tongues. In the 60s and 70s, people went nuts about this, and there was just churches were split in two in the 60s and 70s, even into the 80s. Catholic Church didn't have any problem with it. What they did, they had a separate order for it. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, this is it. You want to speak in tongues? Great. Go to Steubenville, Ohio, Father John Bartolucci. He'll help you. He'll fix you right up. See, I know Father John Bartolucci. I don't know him personally, but see. He'll fix you right up, but that's how they do it. It makes sense. It's a system that we're not accustomed to, okay? We're not accustomed to that in that regard. But it helps say, in the Eastern Church, they don't do it that way at all. They just have monks who are not a part of they don't even have to be ordained or priest or anything or go through any kind of holy orders or anything like that. They just can be a common person and go away and cloister themselves and study and read the church fathers. Yes. Right. Exactly. Well, Luther wore a hair shirt that was uncomfortable. I mean, that whole idea of self-debasement is very common in these sort of things. And that's kind of where it gets extreme, and that's why, this is the caricature that Protestants make of it. We'll see how crazy it gets, and we don't want to do that. Exactly. Exactly. There you go. Absolutely. It's a system, too. Doesn't work. It's expensive. It's an expensive... How do you know what you get? Well, you do need a scorecard, and that's why you got to come to a guy like me who keeps the scorecards. I'm sort of the umpire. Yeah. But how do you know what you're getting when you go? That's a great point, because you don't. Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, even... That's true. Well, and that is a really interesting perspective on... I mean, my dad, who grew up in a Lutheran church, when Lutheran churches, well, he thought they were all the same. He didn't know that they were not. He shows up to a church with the green hymnal. Now, admittedly, he had not been to church since they started the green hymnal. That should tell something about my dad. But when they got to the Lord's Prayer, which is in the green hymnal, which is not the traditional one, and when they got to a different reading of the Apostles' Creed, which is not the one that he was used to, he shut the book and stopped going. Because he says, they don't care about me. They don't care about me because they're changing things. Well, you don't do that unless you convene a church council. And then the church council, everybody gets together and says, yes, this is how it is. We all do it. And then we all do it. Okay, that's kind of how it is. In the Orthodox Church, it's a little bit harder because convening a church council, you don't have just one bishop. You've got five patriarchs that you have to get involved on the thing. But when they're done, they're done. This particular thing is a helpful thing for us to realize that there are spiritual disciplines, and that's the word I want to get at. There are spiritual disciplines to practice that help us draw close to God. It may not be this. I mean, there are other ones. I think fasting, taking a silent retreat, doing things for the poor, I think is probably a really good thing. I mean, the fact that we're going to be doing... I mean, if people regularly go to do something like Great Plains Food, is there a Great Plains Food? Did I get that right? You know, regularly serve there, or regularly serve at New Life Center, right? Go regularly. I mean, that's a spiritual discipline, in a sense. I mean, as I said, that is a spiritual discipline you can do on a regular. Reading the Bible on a daily basis is a spiritual discipline. They're all manner of spiritual discipline. We get, as well, this is where our hang-up about this is that it looks suspiciously like works righteousness to us, which of course is the worst thing you can do in our line of Christianity. Our brand of Christianity is that you want to run the opposite way of anything that even remotely resembles works righteousness.
So that's where the parable of the Good Samaritan comes in, where people are, they don't want to go near a dead body or a potential dead body.
This is where the parable of Good Samaritan comes in. You don't want to go near a dead body, because you touch a dead body, you are ritually unclean. Okay? Which, you know, and Jesus turns this all upside down. I mean, Jesus just goes nuts. I mean, Jesus is Jesus is calling out a woman who sneaks up behind him, who's been hemorrhaging for umpteen years. You know, you talk about unclean, 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 you know, and then he heals her, for crying out loud. I mean, this is just nuts. I mean, Jesus takes this and just goes towards. Now, what's interesting though is this. Whereas there are many, many quotations from the book of Genesis in the New Testament, like 40-some, maybe 34. Is it 30? Well, hang on, I've got it written down there. Where have I written this down? I've written it down somewhere. And there are about 30-some odd in Leviticus, about 40-some from Exodus, and there's 50-some from Deuteronomy. There's only three quotations from Numbers in the New Testament. Curious, very curious as to why that is. But there's all kinds of good stuff. We've just sort of scratched the surface. But here's a practical thing. I mean, for us in our spirituality today, I think it is a good thing for us to think maybe that there is some times that we can set aside, God, I want to draw a little bit closer to you, and so I'm going to set apart a season, and we can determine what that season is. We don't have to. We're free in the gospel. Let's just say that. We're free in the gospel, and we can set aside a season to do something like that, to say, you know, I'm going to do this for the sole purpose of trying to draw close to you. Okay? Let's stop there and see if anybody's got any questions about stuff we've talked about thus far. Or anything else?
I had just an odd thought, as I often do.
Odd thought.
I was thinking here you have 600,000 able-bodied
yes.
men, plus all the
stuff, all the accoutrement, yes. Yes.
Is everybody seeing these? Or, you know, is it the word spread? How does communication go with something like that?
Is everybody seeing the miracles that go on? You know, that's a great question. The answer is yes. Everybody is seeing the stuff that's going on. Because you can't cross the bottom of the seabed without seeing that you're crossing the bottom of the seabed.
And of course now that you...
You can't drink water in a desert without seeing... Wow, where did this water come from? You can't eat this flake and manna without thinking, where did the manna come? The point of the matter is this. Yes, every last one of them got to see the hand of God at work. Everybody. No one can say, well, you know, I was absent that day. Well, if you were absent that day, you wouldn't have gotten here. Other questions? Observations? Time to go home. Let's do that. And let's show Seth that I can get done before 96 minutes. Okay. Father, we thank you so much for your word. Thank you for those who have gone before us and given us an example in faith, particularly those who set their lives apart for a season to draw close to you. Stir us up to that very end, for we ask it in Jesus' name, and we're bold to say, amen. Oh, how could I forget? How can I forget? Quiz. Let's see who's paying attention on Sunday. What's my favorite thing to do in the church service? The benediction. Would you mind somebody? Well, would you mind continuing reading after chapter 6, verse 21? Which is where the Nazarite vow ends. Would you mind reading that? I'm just curious. I've just got a hunch. Just a hunch.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them.
Isn't that a cool thing? So Moses and Aaron will put the name of God on the people of Israel and bless them. That's why I love doing that every Sunday. It's so much fun. God bless you. Go in peace and serve the Lord.